has been established that persons who have recently died have been returning to life and committing acts of murder. Civil defense officials in Cumberland have told newsmen that murder victims show evidence of having been partially devoured by their murderers.
Hello, they out there in listening land. Greetings, welcome everyone. It's David and Tim again. And we want to say thank you for tuning in to Johnny Has the Keys podcast. Yes, that's where you are. You're at Johnny Has the Keys. An examination of horror, science fiction, films, television, whatever we want to do this week. Each episode, we're going to cover some favorite movies or some favorite television series. We're going to talk about them, how they influenced us, and hopefully how they influenced other people. And we've had a pretty good time so far. It's fun getting together with my buddy Tim and doing this. And how you been, Tim? What have you been up to?
Oh, I've been good. I have to say I've been enjoying this as well. I've kind of looked forward to this particular one.
I'm sure.
It's the middle of summer. It's hot here. Other than that, everything's great.
Cool. Anything happen this week or anything up that's bothering you, that's making you happy? I mean, what's been up?
My favorite thing this week, I actually have a couple of things going on. One is audio. Well, actually, they're both audiobook related. I do a lot of audio because I have that kind of time as far as being in a vehicle. And I don't know if you've heard. Well, actually, I know you've heard of it. We've talked about it. But there is a new X-Files radio play that was produced by Audible.com called Cold Cases. They've taken key actors from the show, including David Duchovny and Gillian Anderson, Mitch Pileggi, and the Lone Gunman. And they've put together this, it's a little over 4 hours, about five episodes that could have taken place between the first X-Files movie and the revival on television.
Yeah.
It's really good stuff. I wish that they had used some of these for the series, the miniseries that came back last season with six episodes, because some of this stuff is actually better than that. So that's
really? Okay.
That's one of my really cool things. I'm not going to say anything to give it away, because if there are any hardcore X-Files fans out there, you are going to love this. Trust me.
Well, as a tangent, X-Files, because both of you and I both love X-Files. It falls into our niche market so well. But did you think the revival was too much trying to make up for history and kind of mythological rather than just good storytelling like they used to do? Or what?
I think it was a little bit too much, especially that last episode. That last episode, I really just almost got up and walked out of the room. Yeah, I got really mad. I don't mind the history and them having a kid and having to bring all that into it. And you know, because it actually the kid kind of takes the place of Mulder's sister when she was missing in the originals. I think if they were going to try to do as much as they did in six episodes, they should have went ahead and done 12 episodes and incorporated what I listened to yesterday. I think it would have helped spread it a little over the course of a longer amount of time. It wouldn't have been so much in your face. You know, it was like, oh, my God, we've only got six episodes. We've got to do this. Whereas they should have just taken their time with it. And hopefully with this new one coming out this fall where they have 10 episodes, it'll be a little smoother transition. I'm just glad they're working on it.
Right. Yeah, but we have to get Mulder back. I mean, you know, spoiler alert, but
right.
You know, how are we going to get him back?
Yeah, like so. That never happens.
That never happens, no.
But I do have a slightly other, I do have one little thing I want to pull out of the past. It's a nugget that you may appreciate. I'm not a huge sci-fi reader. Some of the stuff's a little analytical for me, and I just tune out. I'm more into, you know, teenagers being chased through the woods with a guy, you know, and a machete.
Yeah.
But I do occasionally pick up a science fiction novel, and I picked up a classic time travel novel that I had never read called Kindred by Octavia Butler.
Okay.
Have you ever heard of her?
I have not.
Okay. It was written in like 1975, and the time travel is just basically a device to tell a really good story. There's no machine they jump into to go back in time or whatever. It's just used as a device basically. And it's about a black woman that gets transported back 50 years before the Civil War. So whenever she goes back, it's already dangerous for her. And it deals with her meeting her relatives and what, she could potentially do to jeopardize the outcome of her future. But you've got the whole slavery thing going on at the same time. It's awesome. If you've never read it, I highly recommend it. Kindred.
Very interesting.
Kindred by Octavia Butler. So that was my second really cool thing this week. So.
And as a link key, Kindred, one of my favorite series, short-lived series, which was based on the White Wolf game of Masquerade. So great word. Interesting. I guess mine for the week has been, I've been looking in wanting to get back to directing theater again. I've kind of been searching for scripts and looking for what might be cool and something neat to do. And so I've ordered a bunch, read a bunch. This past week has been a lot of reading for theater plays. And one of the ones I read that I'm very intrigued about is called Woman in Black. And it was turned into a movie with Daniel Radcliffe, which was not very good. But the theatrical version was called like one of the scariest live things ever presented. And it lasted for, a couple of decades in London. Very, very popular show. Read through it, and it's very creepy and really cool, and I'm very intrigued about the possibility of staging it somewhere. So
Wow.
that's my big one for the week. It's a good little horror thing for you there.
Yeah, I've seen the movie. I didn't know it was based on a play.
And a really atmospheric play. I mean, you and I both know from the past that it's fun to do live theater. It's fun to have an audience there and also scare the crap out of them if you can. And this one does that. It's nothing overt. It's all done with simple lighting and just atmosphere and a few sound effects here and there so that you really transport them to a place. It's again like being a kid and watching that movie in your basement, through your eyes, through your hands or whatever, because it's all atmosphere less than I'm going to jump out and slit your throat open sort of thing. So, my kind of horror.
Right. Well, a type of horror. I mean, I appreciate different types, so.
True. And speaking of types of horror, I mean, this is kind of an important podcast for us because this is like the one that inspired the whole thing, so to speak, in so many
It's
ways.
our Genesis project.
It is. Damn it, Jim. So tell us, you're the expert. You know, I'm gonna in this week, I'm just going to, give in to you a lot because I think you know a lot more about this particular film than I do. I have, of course, lots of opinions, like I always do. But I mean, for you, well, tell our dear readers the title first in case they haven't guessed already.
Well, folks, we're doing a little film from the late 60s called Night of the Living Dead. Stars Dwayne Jones. It was directed by George A. Romero, who we recently lost to cancer. It's a seminal film. It basically has spawned so many things that are now in our pop culture that it's really kind of hard to keep track. Actually, it's very hard to keep track, especially if you look at all the dreck that is out there as well. It was a labor of love by a group of people in Pittsburgh. I don't know if you knew this. This is a handy little trivia bit, David. Did you know that Romero worked for Fred Rogers on the Mr. Rogers Show?
No, but now I'm just imagining.
Yeah, it you know it.
Seriously?
Yeah, Mr. Rogers was filmed in Pittsburgh, and Romero said that I'm not sure if it was before or after he formed Latent Image, which was his company. He said, "You really didn't do this kind of work in Pittsburgh unless you had worked with Mr. Rogers." He was like the bigwig there.
That's why King Ferdinand was so weird. That's why.
And that lady George Elaine Turner. Or whatever her name was. Yeah, those puppets creep me out.
Interesting.
So yes, so some of those people, I'm sure some of the others may have worked there as well, but Romero definitely worked with Fred. I don't know for how long. I just I caught this either in an interview or a commentary not long ago. The couple that play Helen and Harry Cooper, her name is Eastwick, his was Hardiman. They had something to do with develop processing or something. So one of the reasons they're involved is I think they're the ones that got the print made. I mean, a lot of these guys that are in the cast basically are responsible for producing the picture as well, or funding it, or you know, in some way or another having a major part in making sure that it got done. And it was actually shot in 32, which a lot of people don't believe because the prints were so bad to begin with. You know, when they finished, they threw it in the trunk of their car and took it to New York and just said, hey, let's find a theater that'll play it.
Yeah, there's some of that I want to talk about production values and some of the decisions that they, as a team, and Romero as a director, I think, and co-writer made at the time, and how kind of somewhat timely, and sometimes some of them were ahead of their time in the decisions they made. But for our gentle listeners, maybe a little synopsis to begin with, which I'll take a stab at, and you just tell me where I go wrong.
Sure, go
but
for no.
but basically, the story it begins with a brother and a sister who are visiting their father's grave,
correct?
Mother's grave, one of the graves, and they end up getting attacked. The brother ends up being knocked on a gravestone and probably dead, but we're not sure. The sister named Barbara hysterically runs away from this shambling guy who is chasing her.
The prototype zombie.
A prototype zombie, I like the term, ends up finding a farmhouse, going inside it. Eventually, a guy arrives in a truck named Ben. He's also on the run from these things and seems to know a lot more about them. And basically, as characters arrive, not really arrive, they find out that they're people that have been staying in the basement of this particular, or the cellar.
Yeah, that's a huge plot twist.
Farmhouse. And the fact that nobody really knows what's going on. They just know that these things are out there. They want to kill them. They can break through doors if they have enough force. They're not very strong. They're kind of slow, but there's a lot of them. And slowly the movie dissolves into how these people try to cope, try to survive, try to put up with what's happening, try to find out what's happening in the outside world, and then hopefully eventually try to escape. However, it does not end well. One of the things that I do like about this film, much as I do like musicals that always end sad, none of the original characters survive the farmhouse in this movie, which is a really cool, bold, again, back to Romero's choices. I think that's a bold choice to have made with this movie. So that's basically it. It's set up so much that we're going to talk to and dive into. But it's a very simple story, a very simple location, and very uniquely shot to create the moods that he wanted. When was the first time you ever saw this movie? Do you remember?
I knew you were going to ask me that, and I really don't. I saw Dawn of the Dead, I think, first as a midnight movie in the early 80s. And, you know, about that time was when VCRs and videotape were becoming popular. And I'm fairly certain I either rented a copy or bought one of those cheap public domain copies from a bin at a store. I was, upon an initial viewing, I was a little disappointed because Dawn is so in your face and great. I was like, well, I knew it was in black and white, but these guys aren't the greatest actors. And I just was not as impressed with it. But, you know, I let it simmer for a while. And, of course, just like any of these movies, they get under your skin. And in retrospect, it might be one of my favorite movies of all time because of what it did, which is basically it broke all the rules of horror movies at that time, and basically set precedents for horror movies to come in the 70s. I mean, there are no heroes in this movie, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Pretty much everybody dies. Yeah, everybody does die, I think. Yeah.
And
you just didn't see that. You know, we were talking about the thing in a previous podcast, the original thing, you know, you had your heroes. They talk fast. We can beat this thing. We'll just set it on fire or whatever. Well, you know what? These things are set on fire, but they're not, you're still not winning. You know,
mm-hmm.
It's like, it's almost a metaphor for something like cancer. They just keep coming back.
Well, and I think it's interesting that at the time when this was released, which was, what, 68, 69? It was.
Yeah, I'm not sure what the exact release was, but it was filmed then for sure.
And to have an anti-hero kind of feel wasn't popular at the time. I mean, for modern listeners now who have never seen the movie, going back to it, and I'm kind of like that. I had not seen this movie in quite a long time, so I was revisiting it for this podcast. And I have mm-hmm. to admit, even what you said, some of the acting may be over the top. Some of the music is extremely bombastic and in your face sort of thing. But the mood he creates from the very beginning of just the car driving on the dirt road and hearing that over the top music. But then there's this, once you get to the farmhouse and once Ben's there and night descends, it really becomes a really creepy, moody piece. And his pacing and timing mm-hmm. works really strongly all the way through it. And it did. It did set the precedent, I think, for so. I think it was probably the usher in of a lot of like the slasher films and everything else that came about in the late 70s, 80s, that whole feel. My personal story is kind of unique, and especially since I'm not the big horror guy that you are. But the very first time I saw this, a little backstory, there was a drive-in in town here, and I went and saw a movie called Frogs.
You're talking about Sunset.
Yeah. And
I know that drive-in. I saw the thing there.
Oh, okay, cool. but I went and saw a movie called Frogs, which was basically this ecological horror story about frogs and insects and spiders and nature taking over and killing these people on this little island off the coast of Georgia or whatever.
If I may interrupt, I do believe Ray Milland is in that movie.
Yes, he is. He is the patriarch of said Georgia estate. Yeah.
Yeah, I've seen that.
Anyway, so I went and saw it, and then they said, you know, next week is the release of this new horror movie. You're going to want to see it, and we're going to do it as a double feature with a classic horror movie. So I said, oh, okay, it's going to be Creature from the Black Lagoon or something like that. Turns out, no. Came back the next week. It was Night of the Living Dead, followed by Texas
awesome.
Chainsaw Massacre.
That is awesome.
Yeah. So I did not sleep
like
for about a month and a half.
Me.
Yeah, that was really disturbing to see both of those back to back for me, and to see the kind of the comparison. I'm thinking about it now, and maybe I'm making some of this up in retro, but the comparison of one being in black and white, one being in color, which again goes back to choices, which we could talk about later, the whole black and white thing. But anyway, that was my so naturally it has a seminal effect on me from a horror perspective because, and when we finally did The Exorcist, I'll tell you my other big horror story. But that was definitely an impression, you know, as an impressionable little child there, getting ready to go into high school, that terrified me.
Yeah, I would say so.
Yeah.
With good reason.
With good reason, yes. things that I took away from this viewing, so maybe. I just put a list of just things that hit me. You know, we said pretentious movie, music. It's because it was library music, right? I mean, he didn't have an orchestrator for this or something. He just kind of found music and put it in there that was free.
You know, he did. And even though it's hokey, some of it I just love. I hear it in my head all the time. Da-da-da-da, da-da-da-da-da.
Agreed. Agreed. And I mean, but again, it's in black and white for those who haven't seen it. It's in a 3:4 format. So it's kind of odd on screens nowadays. It's in like old 50s movies were. Some of the acting, some of the costuming, some of the makeup seems like bad community theater to me. Kind of over the top, not the best, but it unnerves you still. I think Dwayne Jones, the guy who plays Ben, the lead guy, is great in the role. There are times when he's over the top, but overall, he's a very strong character. He's the closest we get to a hero in this whole movie. He makes the decisions. He takes the action. He does great stuff. And he was... Had he done anything before this? Was this like his first movie or something, or what?
You know, I'm not really sure. I know he was selected not because he's black. I know he was selected because he was the best audition.
Yes, that was a big point because I read that it was originally written as a non-descript character. Could be anybody. Could be Caucasian, could be black, could be Asian, you know, whatever. And Romero did not have any preconceived notions. And that this guy he thought was the best for the part.
Correct. He was supposed to be sort of a redneck trucker to begin with. I'm looking at his IMDb page right now, and there's only four films on there, and the next one came out in 73, so that was his first job.
Yeah.
He may have been a local actor.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. Good. I think he's great. Barbara, of course, just I think is hemmed in kind of because of the character, but she's a little bit hysterical, a little bit crazy.
I did read about her. They wanted her to be strong, but she did catatonia so well that they decided to go the other way with it.
Interesting.
And we'll get to this later, but I heard that's why Tom Savini in the remake made Barbara strong, because she was originally written strong.
Okay.
So. That's a little bit of trivia for you right there. But she's a nutcase in this one. She's a definite nutcase.
Oh my gosh. But she did give us the title of our entire podcast. So, I mean, that comes from her.
Yeah. So, hey, everybody. She's responsible for us.
It's all her fault. Let's blame Barbara.
Barbara made us.
They're coming to get you, Barbara.
Okay, so thoughts about it.
Johnny, stop it. You're ignorant.
They're coming to get you, Barbara.
Stop it. You're ignorant.
They're coming for you, Barbara.
Stop it. You're acting like a child.
Some good points. I love the fact that it's black and white. I love the fact that he uses these kind of Scotch angles, these kind of very tilted, handheld kind of feel to it, especially once he gets into the house. I think the opening's a little overlit, a little crazy, a little weird-looking lighting-wise. Everything's very, very washed out kind of feel and not very scary, even with this shambling guy roaming around trying to knock everybody into cemetery stones.
But you still have really cool shots, like when he looks up from Johnny at Barbara, and it's like that crazy, crooked Batman angle.
Yeah, the Scotch angle.
The lightning flashes and hits him. That's a classic shot.
Yes, definitely. And I love once they get to the house, all the moody lighting, all the shadows everywhere. The fact that like the whole going up the staircase sequence is great and scary and very Hitchcockian kind of feel to it.
If I may interject, I think a lot of that photography he was trying to emulate, like Jacques Tourneur, is that how you say his name?
Yeah.
That did Cat People and those famous films that were shot in black and white in the 50s.
Yeah, that would make sense.
You see a lot of, I guess that's a key as far as production wise. There's a lot of influence from Hitchcock and Tourneur in this film.
Definitely.
For sure.
And he does it so well. He keeps the pacing up. At the times when it needs to be a warm and nice shot, he frames it very straight and very, you know, like Barbara on the sofa and him at the mantle doing the fire kind of thing, or her at the refrigerator with the knife. I mean, they're filmed very straight and very calming almost. And that's what makes the frenetic stuff later on so much scarier and creepier, moodier. Some things I like. Let's see. I love the music box shot when she's looking around and it actually shoots through the music box as it opens up and shows her eyes. I think that's kind of cool. That was really neat. I was really thrown off.
I always imagined that that's what she's hearing in her head.
The whole time. That's why she keeps screaming.
Yes, yeah. Exactly.
Ben shows up. He immediately starts taking charge, wanting to board up the house, protect it, take care of everything. Meanwhile, she's just kind of still catatonically roaming around with the loudest freaking cricket in the world, by the way. That bugged the hell out of me that whole scene. She's walking around. I'm going, where is this cricket? Just kill it. It's killing me. Then suddenly, everybody in town decides to show up to this warehouse, this farmhouse. I do have kind of an issue with that because it's kind of portrayed, or you get the feeling at least from the beginning of this, that this is a very rural area. You know, they are miles away from anywhere because they're way out, the way it's just shot at the beginning. Yet, everybody in this freaking town seems to come to this one farmhouse. I mean, at one point, I literally stopped and froze frame and counted 35 zombies. So I'm going, where did they come from? I don't know. These people all come into this house. But anyway, that's just me. That's just the...
My theory with that is that they were probably following the sound of Ben's truck, and they're just slow.
Yeah.
I mean, I really love what you said earlier about that opening shot. It's a really long shot of the car in a distance coming toward the cemetery, and they're like showing the credits. And it takes a really long time for that car to get there. And it reminds me of the pace of the zombies. It seems like, you know, this is a creeping terror, you know, and when it gets here, it's going to get here, but you got to wait. Mm-hmm. And I kind of felt the same way with those zombies that show up. I'm like, you know what? They're not making a lot of noise, but they are hammering. You know, they're hammering, putting up boards and stuff, and you know, noise attracts zombies.
Well, and screaming at each other.
Ben was escaping from something.
Yeah.
I mean, the zombie chased Barbara, so it makes sense that zombies are chasing Ben as well, especially if he's in a trot.
True. So, and they are making, to your point, they are making noise from that, you know, the banging, screaming at Cooper, throwing stuff around, breaking tables up. Yes.
Well, and Barbara screaming.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah. Yes. Other things, just glancing at my notes, and then I'll let you go. I liked the a lot of the low angles that were dual angles. Like, I love the whole sequence when they finally get the television and they're watching the television, and it's always every shot has two people in it, all listening and seeing how they react to the newscaster talking about, we don't know what's going on, but the dead are rising, you know, all that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
The girlfriend, the one that's in the basement, every time they show her, she has that soft focus 60s bad Star Trek filter, is what I call it. You know what I mean? Where she looks, she looks beautiful. Oh, look at her. Kind of thing.
Hi, I'm an ingenue.
Yeah. The fist fights are all kind of badly staged and don't work right, but still they add to like the overall sense of it. Questions that I have. Why do you think he filmed it in black and white rather than color? Because color was popular in the late 60s. It was happening.
You know, that's maybe more of a question for you because I don't know a lot about film stock, but I was thinking that maybe black and white was still cheaper then.
Well, it would be. It would be cheaper, so it's probably on it. Because this was a low budget, right? It was like, let me look at my note. It was $114,000, which I read online was the equivalent of like almost $800,000 in 2017. So extremely cheaply made and grossed like $30 or $40 million. So, yeah, I think it would be a budget constraint to do that because it would be easier, especially if you're filming in 35 or 16. You mentioned the beginning, and it's kind of a weird segue here, but you mentioned the beginning and the car coming down the dusty road seeming to take forever and everything. The first thing that hit me was, and this is a key probably or an influence, the beginning of Evil Dead is the same way with that car driving in the woods sort of thing, going down the dusty roads, and it reminded me of that. It reminded me of
that.
Yeah,
I see that.
You know, and Sam constantly
talks about...
Probably
the same model.
Sam constantly talked about the fact that they should have done this in black and white when we were shooting Evil Dead. He was always, should have done this in black and white. It would have been a lot cheaper. So even, you know, then it was still cheaper to do black and white, especially for 1635, than you would for color. An incongruity that I saw, and again, this may be due to just the way it was shot or whatever, because I did read online that the very last scene they filmed was the cemetery scene. Everything else was before that. So all of that filmed later, and that's why it doesn't really match up with Barbara's story of what actually happened detail by detail. It kind of works because it makes her seem hysterical, like she doesn't really remember and doesn't know all the details. But it's because they filmed that sequence after that.
So a little bit of guerrilla filmmaking where they're riding on the go.
Yeah, and great point, because I did read that. They picked that cemetery because it was so isolated, and they didn't want anybody to follow them or know that they were up there shooting or to even have to ask permission. So they just wanted to go and do that. And a little trivia thing, the only reason that Barbara scrapes up the car is because the actual car was owned by one of the guys in the cast, one of the producers, or whatever. And in between the original shots of driving on the road and filming the cemetery scene, it got in an accident. And so Romero just kind of wrote it in that it would crush up the door. There you go.
I read that too. That was one of the things from my initial, you were asking me about first impressions of seeing this film. That really bugged me the first time I saw it. I was like, girl, you know, do something. Try to steer that car. Don't let it run into that stupid tree. And now we know, of course, that it was done on purpose.
But yeah, I think there was a lot of that frustration with her, you know, from film trips to just screaming the whole time to what, you know, you just want to, what's Ben's line? Shut up or calm down?
I think you should just calm down. Yeah.
Okay, but anyway, the inconsistency I was getting at, first of all, the inconsistency was, obviously at the beginning of the film, we're in the day. Then, obviously, Ben gets there, we're still in the day, when the truck drives up and the guy's broken in half, zombie guy.
Are you talking about the remake, or are you talking about the original?
No, I'm talking about the original.
Ben doesn't get there till night.
Correct. So it's nighttime.
Let me add to that. That nighttime comes really quickly because Barbara goes to a window and sees that zombie from the cemetery quite conveniently ripping the telephone line down from the house. And then she runs and checks the phone. And then when she runs back to the window, it's dark. It's like really fast. Yes. It's like, wow, it got dark really quick.
Well, and then, so Ben shows up, it's night, they end up finding the Coopers and the other couple downstairs, they end up doing the board up, now suddenly every zombie in the entire county is coming towards us, yada yada, then they find the television, and then they go into another little battle sequence, and then they wait because there's going to be a broadcast at 3, I mean like 3 of them say that, we're waiting for the broadcast at 3, and I'm thinking, 3 a.m.? 3 what? What do you mean 3? But everything on the broadcast is during the day. Everything on the broadcast, they show the, you know, the wild zealots out shooting zombies and the sheriff doing his roundup everybody while I chew my cigar kind of thing. All that's in the daytime. So
you just didn't see the little message that said previously recorded.
I know. Yeah, there you go. Record earlier today or whatever. Yeah.
It's funny that you bring that up because that had never occurred to me, but it is funny that you bring that up.
Well, and then, you know, and this happens in film a lot. I'm just being a nitpicker, but, you know, when they do the big truck escape, we're going to get the truck to the pump. Two of the shots they show with the truck driving is obviously afternoon, early morning now, let's say, because it's very daylight outside. But then they get to the pump and suddenly we're at night again. And I'm going, okay, when was this shot? I mean, just, I'm getting confused. Because it all is supposed to be one day, right? It's all one night.
It's all one night. Living I mean, I'm sure that some of the shots were done with some kind of filter to make it look dark. And I'm sure mistakes
Spielberg
were made.
Spielberg did it, so it's fine.
I mean, I can give you an even bigger mistake with that scene. When that truck drives to the gas pump, it has headlights. And they bust the headlights out while it's parked. So where do those headlights come from?
Okay, so
I know where you're going.
This movie, this movie set the tropes for zombies for up until now. I mean, we're getting ready for the new season of Walking Dead,
right?
And it is heavily influenced by George Romero and Night of the Living Dead. So it's a definite key. But was he making these rules up as he went, kind of thing? Because, I mean, one of the standards is they can't use tools. They're just kind of mindless walking things with big teeth, and they can scratch and bite and eat, but they're very slow, they're very weak, and they can't use tools. Because even Romero, later on in one of the sequels, made a deal about, oh my God, it's using a tool. And that was a big freaking thing. But yet the very first zombie he ever created, this... guy in the black suit, that guy,
yeah,
uses a rock to break through the window,
which is pretty.
And then later on,
fierce. I must
breaking
say,
through, what
I said, it's pretty fierce. I must say, it freaked me out when he.
Oh yes,
that. Yeah,
yeah, yeah. Great shot and really good. But I was going, if they can do that, then this is really scary. And like your point, yes, they break out the windows. They pick up stuff and start beating on the doors. And so, I don't know, was it scripted, that description? Or was he kind of making it up as he went?
Well, I think he was making it up as he went. He does not use the word zombie in this movie because
you're right.
He referred to them as ghouls. He didn't want them to be vampires, even though he was influenced by a written work that I'll mention later. Let's just put it this way. I think he knew more what he wanted to do when he filmed Dawn of the Dead. So there are at least four things I can mention right now that zombies do in this movie that they don't do in future movies. One is him using that rock to smash the window. One is him ripping that telephone line down. I mean, I'm sure maybe it was in his way, but it kind of looks like he's doing it on purpose to me.
Okay, interesting.
And then two of the zombies pick up rocks and smash out the headlights on the truck. They wouldn't do that. And also, Karen kills her mother with a garden trowel, and zombies don't use weapons that way.
Yes,
yeah,
big one.
It's kind of calculated. And she doesn't feed on her either, which is unusual.
Correct.
So he later said that, you know, since he was responsible, rather unintentionally, for recreating the zombie myth, you know, from Haitian voodoo to modern dead cannibal, whatever, he then started kind of laying down the rules that they're, you know, they're brain dead, so they're not very smart. They move slow. They're dangerous in numbers. But in that first film, obviously, you know, it's like we were saying, it was guerrilla filmmaking, and they were kind of, you know, just, hey, what would be scary? Let's do this. You know, let's get rid of the light. You know, we'll just have one of them smash a headlight or whatever. You know, we don't need a phone, so get rid of that phone line, that kind of thing. It's respectable for a first film, but, you know, he was learning.
Yeah. And I don't think everything has to be exact the first time you do it. I think it's literally amazing what he did create and its legacy even now to that whole, like you said, the whole zombie mythos.
And if you'll pardon that digression, if you jump two films ahead to Day of the Dead, he has a zombie use a gun in that movie.
Right. That's what I was referring to.
I didn't hear you.
Name was,
but.
Yeah, when I said even in one of the later sequels, he has it use a tool,
meaning
the rifle.
Okay. Right.
But he created what ended up, I guess, resonating or sticking with everyone is this show, slow, shambling, they want to eat your flesh, they're not very intelligent. They do not use weapons or tools. They don't congregate. Sometimes they don't even know each other.
Yeah.
And I'll do a plug for it. You know, that influence is really heavily in your novel, which is great. You do great. You have such great sequences in your novel that are so reminiscent of this kind of slow plotting. It's out there. It's coming for you. You can't get away no matter what kind of feel to it. So kudos to you for that. Because
Oh, well, thank you. Maybe I'll finish editing it and publish it.
That would be good. I think you should, because it's really, really good. And I think it would do that.
Well, and when I wrote that, my influence was I Am Legend as well. And Romero has said I Am Legend is an influence for him on this film. So I did want it to be small and you know, in a small community. And that's what this is. The farmhouse is a tiny community, a microcosm.
Yeah, which makes sense. It's kind of interesting. I Am Legend is kind of like one solitary guy after all of this has happened. And this is like it happening, like at the beginning, the genesis of it, I guess, kind of feel, you know, of a plague, an epidemic, or whatever. You don't have any answers. You don't know what's happening, but you just know you have to survive, kind of feel. I mean, I'm sure we'll go into it later on with all the list of influences, but yeah, the whole survival horror story, I think, was created here too.
Yeah, it's definitely one of the first post-apocalyptic films that I can think of.
Yeah.
Successful, anyway.
I couldn't think of stuff prior to this. You know, prior to this, the 50s influence was bug-eyed monsters or classic monsters. That was what a horror movie was. It was a creature, a singular, usually, creature coming to get you. And this is multiple creatures in a world that's falling apart. And you just have to do what you can to survive. You don't have the scientist there to explain everything to you and what happened. You don't have the journalist who knows all the backstory to tell you. It's happening, and you better just good luck.
I just did a quick search. On the Beach came out in 59, and that's kind of a post-apocalyptic film. The Gregory Peck.
Yeah, but
movie.
It's political.
Right.
Yeah,
right.
But it's political. It's not horror or anything. It's mostly what would you do if the world ended?
Yeah, I've been obsessed with this little topic for a couple of days. I've been trying to think, is there another post-apocalyptic film before this? And I can't think of one. I really can't. And I'm sure there has to be, but anyway.
Well, just after this, you had one of my favorites from my genre world, which is Planet of the Apes.
Oh, my God, I love that movie.
And that, you know, that is a great post-apocalyptic in so many words. As a matter of fact, it has a huge twist of post-apocalyptic at the end of it. So that kind of thing. But, no, I do think this, my recollection is that this is one of the first post-apocalyptic horror tales and survival stories.
Yeah.
It wasn't just, oh, the monster will get us unless we're careful, or the giant spider is going to break through our house. It's okay, you're all stuck here. Good luck.
Yeah, and you know, to me, I'll dive into this for just a second. One of, you know, when people come to me and they say, oh, yeah, you're the horror guy. Oh, you like, you know, zombies and monsters. I do, but there is something about a post-apocalyptic scenario that is so seducing to me. It is like one of my favorite things. It's why I liked I Am Legend. It's why I liked the Omega Man, that stupid movie that was based on I Am Legend. It's why I like this. There is something, this is going to sound stupid, it's like comfort food. And I've often equated horror movies as comfort food. But there's something reassuring to me, Are cool to me about most of the world is gone and you're the only one left, or you and a few people are the only ones left. What do you do? And you and I have talked about this.
Right.
When we used to make, you know, little films when we were younger, when we were fooling around with a video camera, we were like, oh yeah, let's have a party at the end of the world. You know, what would you do? Blah, 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 blah. You know, I'd get on the roof and look at the sky, whatever. There's just something really... Well, obviously, if you go on Amazon right now and look in the subcategory of horror under post-apocalypse, there's a million books out there. I mean, it's not just me that likes this subject matter. There are a lot of people that like this subject matter. It's why The Walking Dead is so popular right now. It's not just
Agreed.
zombies. So anyway,
Well, you know,
digression over.
I stay you and I both did a production of Macbeth that was set post-apocalyptic.
Oh, that's
So,
right.
you know,
After a
I mean, we
nuclear
love
war.
that sort of thing. Yeah. And you kind of you inspired me a little bit of a tangent, but post-apocalyptic wise, there is a great, it's like almost a 2-hour documentary on the making of Mad Max, the original Mad Max.
Really?
And it is great too. Talking about the vision of the world and what it was going to be like and the hardships of filming it and all the stunts and all the stuff they had to do for it. And George Miller had never done a movie before. A lot of similarities to Romero here in trying to create a mythos that later inspired others to do the same sort of thing. Also with a singular kind of crazy vision, whether it's bikers or Mohawks or whatever.
Is that on some platform I have? Is that on like Netflix or anything?
Yeah, I think you can find it on YouTube. I
Okay.
can't remember the name of it, but it's kind of like the behind the scenes Mad Max or something.
If we ever do that movie, I've got a great story as far as a first impression with that.
Oh, cool.
Yeah.
That would be great.
Okay.
Okay, so just finishing up. So back to this work, scary things I liked. I think the Karen zombie was really creepy. The little girl was actually creepy. And that whole saving that for near the end and for the whole matricide with the trowel thing, even though we don't like the trowel being used, but that whole kill your mom kind of thing and the scream that Helen has is just so great and scary and everything.
Well, and there's a metaphor in that as well, where, the whole time they spend boarding up the house to keep the stuff out, it's actually in there the entire time.
Yes.
Because
Yeah.
we
Yeah.
are
The
it, basically.
cancer, for lack of your better word, for using your better image from before, the cancer is in us already. It's
Right.
already here. It just hasn't, developed yet. That's very true. I loved the twist with the zombies are breaking down the door and she looks and it's one of them is Johnny. I mean, that was awesome. And the fact that it was just the gloves that gave it away, because at the beginning I kept thinking, why is he freaking playing with these gloves all the time? He's putting them on, he's taking them off, he's throwing them around, he's slapping them on the tombstone. What is with these driving
He
gloves? And
actually
then you
throws
find
them
out,
on the
oh, duh, he
dashboard.
wants us to remember them because that's the only way we'll recognize Johnny.
Oh no, what I was saying is that he throws those stupid gloves on the dashboard and then later on he's walking around the cemetery putting them back on. I'm like, how'd he get them?
Well, yeah, because like I said, I think the point was we have to remember those gloves because that's the only way we're going to recognize Johnny,
Right.
at the end. And I think, okay, so you may not have heard, but I love the way Barbara died.
Yes.
I love the fact that she's literally engulfed by them and just taken away. And then we ramp up to that ending, which I am sure at the time in the late 60s was a huge twist and slap in the face and everything, that this guy that we do somewhat care about and can't wait to see him as the lone survivor just gets plugged like that
Right.
and is just gone. And then my favorite cinematic part of this entire movie is the ending credits,
Yeah.
with that really grainy newsreel crime scene kind of photos, the meat hooks,
Still shot.
Just dragging Ben's body out, throwing it on the fire, all that. That was just so. And that was creepy music, by the way. That kind of really weird ending credit music was really
It's
creepy.
kind of got a 50 sci-fi sound to it.
Not so much theremin, but that kind of feel of something's building and it's going on and it's coming kind of feel. So that left you feeling really like, oh my gosh, I can't believe I just watched that sort of thing. So that was great.
Yeah. I mean, had I seen it back in the day and had been used to, films like Hammer vampire films or whatever was popular at the time, I would say that's the equivalent to a cinematic gut punch. Because
Yeah.
it's just like, whoa, there's no hope, This is it.
Yeah. And so many keys are first in this movie. I mean, so many, like we had talked about, seeing the girl kill her own mother, the actual cannibalism of seeing them do the, you know, they're literally biting through chunks of meat and biting up an arm, and the whole feast kind of thing. I even wrote it in my notes here. I went, woo, naked butt. Because, you know, one of the zombies has a naked butt and is just walking around naked. So I hadn't seen that before in a movie, especially with my young impressionable eyes.
Well, it was also one of the last unrated movies. I think I read that somewhere.
Yes, that is correct. So, it was before the MPAA put all the restrictions on movies.
Right.
And started labeling them.
So throw some nudity in there.
There is, but there's only, you know, the naked butt, surely. Another one I was interested in asking you about as far as keys go from the past. So we know I Am Legend, Romero, I said, influenced him. So that makes sense. What about the other movie that you liked a lot? I wrote it down. Hold on. See if I can find it. The movie you like, Carnival of Souls. Do you think that influenced him at all?
Yeah, that's a huge, huge influence. Romero has cited both I Am Legend and Carnival of Souls as influences for this film.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, that makes sense because it's black and white. It has the creepiness to it. It has that whole kind of taboo, pushing taboos in places at times.
Yeah.
Kind of feel to it. So that makes sense.
That may be worth a podcast episode. I haven't seen that movie in a couple decades, so I'd kind of like to revisit it myself.
Yeah, I would agree with that. Yeah. We should add that to the list.
Yeah.
And Freaks as well. I'd love to see Freaks again because
I love that movie.
I do too.
Yeah, because it was one of those movies when I was a kid that, you know, you heard was so controversial and so, you know, that they had to ban it in so many countries, just like you heard the same thing about Night of the Living Dead. And I was like, I have to see this film. You know, it's like Stephen King says, the minute they ban a book, you need to read it. So I watched Freaks and I loved it. I thought it was great.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Before we go into just our list of keys and everything else, some trivia that I just looked up or found.
Yeah, I've got a little too.
The movie was originally released on October 31st. I thought that was kind of cool.
That's awesome.
That was kind of neat. They used Bosco chocolate syrup for the blood, which was not the same brand, but was also what Hitchcock used in Psycho, of course. So they used that for the blood.
And a lot of those guts were real. They were like from a chicken plant or something. Those people were like really biting into like livers and shit.
Oh, well, I thought that was probably true of that one liver thing.
Yeah.
What about the lady who eats the bug off the tree? Is that a real bug?
You know, that lady that eats that bug is Marilyn Eastman, the same person that played Helen Cooper. And yeah, it is. And I don't know, but that bug looks real to me.
Okay. Unless, I did not know that. That was a big one.
Unless it's rubber and she's kind of twirling it in her hand. It looks like it's squirming. I don't know.
According to IMDb, it was the first full length movie ever filmed in Pittsburgh. So that's kind of cool.
That is cool.
They used over 200 extras in it, including all of the radical, crazy shoot everybody at the end guys. No major character survives the movie, is a trivia bit. And my last little trivia thing, there's no copyright info on the movie. There is no copyright at the end. There is no, because it literally wasn't copywritten.
Right. That was a big mistake.
So, yeah, if you go to Wikipedia, look up Night of the Living Dead, over on the right, you can watch the entire movie. It's so kind of odd, but interesting trivia. What about you? Any trivias?
Well, there is a little. A lot of people out there listening to this podcast may be familiar with the work of Tom Savini, who went on to do tons of makeup effects for George Romero, as well as direct a remake of this. He was originally asked to do the effects for this or be a part of this, but was deployed as a photographer in Vietnam.
Really?
Yeah, and that's one of the reasons he became a makeup artist, I think, is because of all the graphic, awful stuff he saw in Vietnam. So they were friends before this movie was made, or knew each other before this movie was made. Tom just couldn't be a part of it because he was overseas.
Interesting.
Yeah, I thought that was interesting. Reader's Digest warned people away from it, saying that it would inspire cannibalism.
Yes, because everybody reading Reader's Digest on the toilet at that time would be thinking of cannibalism.
Why is that always associated with the toilet? That's hilarious.
I just, that's where I remember it was on my grandmother's toilet seat.
Yeah,
It
it
was
was
in the
that
back
way
of
in my
the, on
house
the
too.
back of the toilet.
Yeah.
You know. You had also said that, like you said, several of the actors were part of the production team, but I didn't know that, like, the Coopers were really married.
She was married to Hardman or Hardiman, however you say his name. And I always wondered if they had something to do with making the print, developing the film. And I always thought it was kind of ironic that her name is Eastman because of Eastman Kodak. And I thought, well, maybe she's, a descendant of that family. I don't know. But they partnered with George, and I think maybe even the forming of Leighton Image, the company that produced the film, and developed the final print. So the Coopers, the couple in the basement, they were major factors in this movie getting made. Bill Hinesman, that played the zombie in the cemetery at the beginning, was a producer, as was Russell Steiner, who played Johnny, Barbara's brother. Johnny's got the keys.
Oh yeah, I remember seeing his name in the credits, but I wasn't sure.
He's Johnny, the guy with the gloves. Who else? Well, Ben was cast from an audition. I'm not sure where Kira or the girl that played Karen, I think her name was Kira. Yeah, Kira Shawn. I'm not sure where she came from, but I have a feeling she was probably the daughter of somebody. So there's it was a labor of love for these folks, and it kind of shows. It reminds me of something that you and I would have done if we had the money.
Oh yeah, definitely. It reminded me of that. I mean, reminded me back of the old films or the shorts that we used to do. I love the whole low budget grunge effect of it. I mean, I've said this before 100 times, but I always believe that small budgets make people be more creative. The bigger the budget, usually the worse the movie ends up being. I mean, this movie is scarier because the budget is smaller, and it's so much scarier than like all of the other, possessed doll movies that are coming out now. I mean, Texas Chainsaw, Halloween, all of those worked better, I think, because of the limited budget. They didn't spend all their money on blowing somebody's face off or something.
Or cheap CGI effects. Another great trivia bit is the reporter. His name is Bill Cardill, and if you're from Pittsburgh, you'll know that he was the local horror movie host, Chili Billy Cardill, that used to do.
Oh, really?
He had his own little Friday Night Frights or Shock Theater or whatever you want to call it, locally, and he was the reporter. And I can't remember all, but the guy that played the sheriff was somehow in their gang as well. I can't remember how, though. Yeah, like you said, or like I said, guerrilla filmmaking at its best. And we did do a little bit of guerrilla filmmaking ourselves. I seem to remember
Yeah.
a friend of ours jumping off a roof once and the reel running out.
Yeah. Yes, that actually happened. And Yeah, that was perfect. Do it again. But I remember, it was different back then. You try to explain that to kids now, and they just don't understand it. I mean, I recently worked on a short film festival locally here, and one of the kids, even he shot his entire film on his iPhone, and I'm trying to explain to them, you're lucky. You can just look back at it and edit it and fix it and change it or whatever, but back when you and I were latent filmmakers, you couldn't do that. I mean, you shot your video on Super 8 or 16 or whatever, and then you had to take it to the drugstore, and they had to ship it off. And then you had to wait till it came back to find out, a week, 2 weeks later that, oh, something went wrong and this doesn't work anymore, or we missed that shot, or the guy fell off the roof and we didn't get it. Sorry.
Right. And then later when we had videotape, the editing equipment was so horrible.
Exactly.
That every time you had a cut, you saw static.
Yes. Yes. I mean, all this was.
So that was terrible too.
All this was before the digital revolution, you know, so to speak.
Right.
So anyway, let's bring it down to the keys. I mean, you know, we are especially fond of this movie because this wonderful little film, Night of the Living Dead, did create this podcast, essentially, or inspire this podcast. Johnny has the keys, which is actually a line that Barbara has in the movie.
You can't start the car. Johnny has the keys.
And, you know, like we've said, keys are things that we think either helped create the movie or that then became keys that influenced other movies, other literature, other genres because of this movie. And for me, the biggest key coming from Night of the Living Dead has to be the mythos. You know, George Romero created this entire zombie mythos, which is so prevalent today. I mean, it's in film, television, comic books, novels, you know, The Walking Dead, 28 Days Later. I mean, there's so many.
World War Z, not too great, but anyway.
Yeah, World War Z. And, and he created this stereotype zombies. Well, it's kind of been pushed now because, you know, now you've got the whole, it's kind of challenged by the fast zombies. I mean, you know, what was that movie with the fast zombies? The real ones.
28 Days Later.
Yeah. You sure? Yeah?
No. The remake of Dawn of the Dead had fast zombies.
Did it?
Two.
Oh, okay. Well anyway.
Dawn. And it's actually pretty good.
Yeah. The remake of Dawn is, yes. I don't think the remake of Night. Yeah, I mean, the remake of Night, I expected so much more, honestly. I was pretty disappointed, especially coming from Tom Savini. I mean, I guess my main things were it wasn't very atmospheric. It wasn't scary. I mean, I've always liked Patricia Tallman. I mean, I've always thought she's been great ever since Babylon 5.
I didn't know she was on that.
She's the reason they defeated the shadows.
Well, if you look her up on IMDb, she's primarily a stunt woman.
Right, but she's an actress as well.
Okay.
Yeah, I think she did an awesome job. I think Romero rewriting it to give her a stronger character was great. So Barbara became a more fleshed out character overall.
I love Tony Todd in it too.
Yeah, I think he did a great job. I've always liked him, but honestly, I felt the Ben in the original was better than Tony Todd was. I mean, he was more level-headed. He was stronger. I mean, he had to put up with the crazy guy and his wife, but I think he handled it a lot better. And Todd plays Ben kind of losing it in places. I mean, he doesn't have as balanced a head. He doesn't have any plans. As a matter of fact, he almost kills what's-his-name at one point. So I kind of struggle. I think the actor, Tony Todd...
Well, Ben does kill Cooper.
No, he does. Actually, Barbara kills him at the end.
Oh, I'm talking about the original, sorry.
Yeah, in the original. But in the remake, it's Barbara at the very end. And I just didn't think he played him strong enough. You know, Barbara actually had more decision-making than he did in it. He didn't really have any plans. He didn't really have anything to do. But in the original, Ben does. What else? I love the camera work in the original much better than what was in the remake. I like all the Scotch angles, and I like all the black and white. And the new one didn't have any of that. It didn't have any mood to the way it was shot. It was very straightforward, very...
It's definitely not as artsy as far as camera angles and photography.
Right.
And I do think that Savini wanted to say, hey, I can do great makeup, because he showed some really cool shots, like that guy, the two in the cemetery, the one that's clothes are coming off because he's been autopsied or something. And then the Mr. Magruder, which I love. No, that's Mr. Magruder. Don't kill Mr. Magruder. And they pull him in. That's a great zombie. He is awesome. And I read somewhere that Tom Savini saw him in a diner and said, you would make a great zombie. And the guy said, okay.
Really?
So, yeah, that's Mr. Magruder. And then that weird Hindu zombie thing that pops in the window too is pretty creepy.
Yeah, but overall...
But that's just Tom showing off, basically.
Yeah, but, I mean, I expected it to be a lot more scary. I mean, especially with Savini, you know, it's a remake, so you would think they would learn from the original and just make it even better and do more on top of it. But he didn't. I mean, makeup-wise, yeah. I liked Todd's makeup at the very end when he zombies out, you know. I think he has great makeup with the cataract lenses and the way he stumbles up out of the basement. That's cool. I did like the scene near the end where Barbara survives and she's surrounded by all the rednecks and you have, you know, the rednecks fighting in the pit and the rednecks, you know, shooting them hanging from the trees.
That's some more trivia for you. George Romero wanted to have a scene in the original with hanging zombies, but racial tensions were so high then in the late 60s, he did not do it because he was afraid it would be portrayed as like a lynching.
Well, makes sense. Well, he got to do it, so that was good. Had a question. In that same scene, there's a helicopter that flies over, and it looks a lot like a news helicopter. Did you think that's an homage? Do you think that's an homage to, like, Dawn of the Dead?
I'm sure it was.
Yeah. I mean, I guess the rest of the problems I had with this movie were that it's a remake, and you know how I feel about remakes. You know, it seems like you would learn from the original and do stuff different or build on it or do it better. But all they do is they try to do all these homages all the time and all this other stuff. And it's not very good or very clever. I mean, they have the sheriff in this one. Instead of him being just a redneck with a hat and a cigar, now he's got an eye patch and bandoliers and everything else. They don't do things as well as the original. I thought the whole part of her brother, you know, and Barbara's death, you know, basically just being pulled into the mass of zombies and everything by her own brother was much better and more powerful and scarier than basically landing in the truck and he's laying there in the truck as a body. That to me just doesn't have the same horror factor and the same fear factor. Other things it has to take, you know, the first scene has to take place in a cemetery. The car has to be crash, you know, you have to throw a rock through the window. All those things were in the original, too. It seems like you would take that idea and do something bigger, better, badder, scarier, instead of just redoing the same thing. You know, one of the things I didn't like in the original was, you know, making it up as you go, and he throws a rock through the window. And he does the same thing in the remake.
Did he really? I don't remember that.
Yeah, he did. He breaks the window out.
Interesting. They did homage to the trowel with the girl killing the mother and the blood splattering on the trowel. I thought that was a good shot.
Yeah, I think that was good. I think the daughter in general was good. I think her makeup was better. The scene was better. Her attacking on the mom was better. I didn't like Cooper, though. I like Cooper in the original better than this one. I mean, I thought the original guy was over the top, but this guy was really, really over the top.
The way and this may be a stupid justification, but I felt like since Barbara was not loony in this one and was kind of a partner with Ben as far as being strategic and brave, I thought they made Cooper more loony to compensate. Mm. That was my justification for it. And I love that actor. He died recently, Tom Tolles or whatever. I think his name's Tom Tolles, that plays Cooper.
Oh, okay. I also saw in the credits Russ Steiner, whatever his name is.
I read that too, and I didn't go back and look for him, but apparently he's one of like the interviewers at the end or something when the newscast, when a bunch of people are out being interviewed and stuff. He apparently has a cameo in it.
Oh, okay. Well, that's good. That's good. Stay in there. Okay, let's see. Just looking through my notes. Overall, no tension, no fear. I even wrote down here, I'm 46 minutes into this and I'm not scared yet. What's up with that? I like the Barbara change. We said that. I like the fact that Helen has a conscience. I wrote down here, I wish Barbara hadn't found those pants. Yeah, I thought the gas explosion was a lot more believable. I mean, I really liked the way they did that.
Oh man, I was really wanting to touch on that because I mean, both times it's like, how stupid are you? You know, let's have a torch well, near a gas tank, or let's shoot the lock off a gas tank. I mean, it's just neither one is a good idea.
Yeah, neither one. No, no. Yeah, but I thought they did a lot better staging-wise.
Rip the fucking thing off. Get out of the damn truck. My sweater's caught.
Yeah.
Yeah, sorry. Oh, yeah. Sorry, I had to go off on that because I did want to talk about Tom and Judy for a second.
Oh, my gosh. She killed me. I mean, the whole time he's saying, stay here, Judy. Stay here, Judy. She goes, okay. As soon as he goes outside, I'm going with him.
I know. Yeah, it is so bad. Yeah, it's like a bad soap opera. Yeah.
In general.
I've got to go.
Okay, so let's go back to the keys. So we talked about the whole zombie mythos thing. Yeah, and we talked about the zombie mythos and how he kind of generated that whole thing. It also, I think, harkens back to like Body Snatchers and those two movies, but in a weird way. Instead of, you know, you being possessed by an alien entity or whatever, instead you lose your entire self. You just become this walking animated corpse thing. You're not even human anymore. And we talked about movies and television. And of course, I think this severely influenced or was a key for The Evil Dead.
Yeah, I was going to mention Evil Dead. Quite clearly, Raimi created his own mythos with his deadites and his version of zombies. But, I mean, he even, and they don't eat you per se, but they will bite you, and they do bite quite often in that first film, if I'm not mistaken.
And talk and laugh. And that whole menace outside feel to it.
Yeah. And they use weapons and they talk. And I mean, they do, but it's still, you can tell he's still heavily influenced. As a matter of fact, I've got, here's a little trivia for you. I watched an interview with Greg Nicotero on the recent Comic-Con convention. Greg Nicotero went on to work for Savini and he did the special makeup effects for Day of the Dead. So he was friends with Romero and Savini. And he also has a lot of heavy hitting friends, including Quentin Tarantino, Robert Rodriguez, and Sam Raimi. And when Land of the Dead, the fourth George Romero movie, debuted or premiered in Pittsburgh in the 90s, I guess it was, Greg Nicotero took Quentin Tarantino, Sam Raimi, and Robert Rodriguez to the Evan City Cemetery, where they all walked around and played zombie. And then he took them to the Monroeville Mall, where they went.
That's awesome.
And walked around and played zombies at the Monroeville Mall. And he told this story on a panel at the most recent Comic-Con convention because the word had just gotten out, you know, about Romero having died. Yeah. And he said that Romero got a huge kick out of those guys showing up at that premiere.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
That's pretty cool. Other notes that I have, just thinking about it, is...
You know, I think that it just... I mean, those are some really great filmmakers, and to show that they loved Romero enough to go to Pittsburgh to a premiere, I just think that's awesome. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so that was something I caught recent.
Okay, looking back, I've got the thing about the metaphor for Romero's movies. You know, it's kind of like... Critics have talked about this is his take on capitalism and how capitalism will slowly eat you away from within. There's a lot of homage to the culture of the 60s. The whole thing about, you know, and especially like in Dawn of the Dead, he created the, you know, we return to the thing we love to do in life, which was, you know, shopping or retail or whatever. He had a strong black male lead in this movie, something that just didn't happen in the 60s. The whole societal breakdown and this feeling of an apocalypse descending on you, you know, that's a key, too. That's influenced so many survival movies, even survival games, for that matter. I mean, if you had to classify monsters, he created this monster. I mean, to me, my classic monster, you know, if we talked about classic monsters, mine would always be the vampire. And, you know, yours would... probably be the zombie.
Right.
And I'm just curious. I mean, why do you think that is? What is this thing with zombies? I mean, what's the huge deal?
Well, like I said, a lot of it for me is just the apocalyptic scenario. First of all, you're talking monsters. I like zombies. To me, I've always had, I guess everyone has, somewhat a fear of dead bodies. When I was a kid, skeletons scared me. I didn't like going to funerals because I don't like seeing, you know, a dead body in a casket. So to have a dead body, you know, stand up and start moving toward you, to me, is probably one of the scariest things I can imagine. Then add the fact that they want to eat you on top of that. That's a pretty scary thing. I wouldn't say that's my only allure to the concept. I think my original thing that I said about post-apocalyptic scenarios, and this is going to sound stupid, but he touched on consumerism and tangible irrelevance in Dawn of the Dead. And now with media being so saturated and there being so many things to consume out there, I'm actually surprised he hasn't done that. Actually, he may have with Diary of the Dead, but I am sometimes overwhelmed by technology. There's just too much of it. Sometimes I don't even want to use an e-reader. I just want to sit down and read a book or go for a walk and not listen to anything. And I often fantasize, wow, what if, you know, this did happen? It would kind of suck to have to run around killing zombies, but at least I wouldn't have to answer the telephone or hear a television set or, you know, drive, you know, whatever. Does that make sense? There's probably some kind of psychosis I have that, you know, would say, oh, you know what? I could live in a zombie apocalypse. It'd probably be a little easier.
Well, it could be. I think there's that. There's the thing that always got me about it from my horror perspective was never a dead body or the dead coming back or any of that, so much as it was that fear that I think is probably prevalent with people when they, you know, watch Shark Week, which is nobody wants to be eaten by something
or torn apart. Whether it's
a tiger or a shark, a zombie, whatever. Nobody wants to be, you know, eaten while you're alive, sort of thing. So I think that's the fear that comes out of it for me, this relentless pursuit. But as far as fear goes, you know, I'm more scared by Michael Myers than I am by a bunch of zombies. And I don't know why. It's just always has been true for me. Because Myers won't stop. He'll keep coming no matter what you do. The zombie, you shoot him in the head, you're good. You know. Or put a screwdriver in his ear. Or a tire iron in his forehead. You know.
Right.
I did like the fact that he slowly gave the reasons as the movie went on, you know, not the cure. I don't want to say that, but the, you know, their society slowly realizing what's happening. And both in the original and in the remake, the Ben characters say, yeah, we already knew that kind of thing, you know, cause he's discovered it through his adventures with the truck and with the how to kill them and everything else.
Yeah, I don't know. As far as being scary, I think it's just the relentless pursuit that they don't stop. You know, they're going to keep coming. I mean, how many dead people are there in the world? And you know, they keep creating more.
Well, and I remember going to see Dawn of the Dead in a theater, and literally this group of people in front of me, and I don't know if we saw it together or not, I can't remember, but
This
group, I think I saw it when I was in college, and I saw it at on-campus theater. This group of people, like three rows in front of us, as soon as that woman goes, oh, honey, in the hallway of the apartment, and he suddenly just bites her whole, like, neck out and everything. This guy like three rows in front went, oh hell no, and they all got up and just went running out of the theater.
Yeah.
And I remember having the conversation that night with my roommates and a bunch of others from college going, okay, it and you and I played this, I think, years later, and I have done it with other people since, but okay, what would happen if it happened right now? Zombie apocalypse starts right now, what do you do?
Right. You know, right. That's all a part of that allure for me, too.
Yeah. What's your course of action? Do you make it to the gun store? Do you buy a boat? Or you steal a boat so you can go to an island? You know, I remember that used to be the ultimate one. Oh, well, I'll just go to an island and survive. And then they started whatever it was. Even he did it. Romero did it in, like, the fourth or fifth sequel.
It was the fifth one where they're underwater. Yeah.
Yeah.
But actually, if you here comes my nerdy horror. Lucio Fulci did a movie called Zombie, where there's a zombie walking around the bottom of the ocean and attacks a shark. I mean, he literally grabs a shark and takes a bite out of it. I don't know how they filmed that shit, especially in Italy.
But, yeah, at that time.
Yeah.
Well, and you know, we both watched it. I think we watched it at the apartment. The Nazi zombies.
Shockwaves.
Shockwaves.
Yeah.
See, yeah.
You know, I know we will touch on this later. You were a part of the production of the original Evil Dead movie, for anyone out there that doesn't know. And we lived in Morristown, Tennessee, where it was filmed. And the premiere of that movie was in Morristown at a little theater called the Capri. And I remember people getting up and running out of that movie. movie was filmed in Morristown, and people, you know, were from there, and that movie scared the shit out of people.
Well, I think, you know, Sam did a great job with that, I think. I mean, because one of the, you know, I've always equated it to, it's the JC haunted house of horror movies. Because the effects are sometimes in your face, sometimes it's cheesy, you know, there's lots of continuity errors. It's not the best movie making, but it doesn't stop.
It just
keeps going, and there's jump scares as well as atmosphere scares, as well as just such a unique, weird vibe to it. You don't really know what's going to happen next.
Mm-hmm.
And that really kept it going, as I think, as a horror movie, and keeps it popular today.
Yeah. Yeah, we'll dive more into that one on another podcast, but I just wanted to bring that up because I do remember people running out of that as well. And, you know, I don't know if it was ever true, but movies like Night of the Living Dead and Freaks and Dawn of the Dead all had this, like, label of being banned in X number of countries. I don't know how true that was or if it was a publicity tool for promotion or what, but...
Yep.
And it dealt with because of taboos, like... cannibalism or nudity or what have you, or, you know, in the case of Freaks, I guess,
well, body. I did read, I think somewhere in my trivia research, I did read that at least in one of its showings, whether it was New York or a major city, Boston, Chicago, somewhere, one of the marketing things was there is an insurance policy for anyone who suffers a heart attack while watching Night of the Living Dead.
Really? That's not a William Castle thing.
So, yeah, Castle did that kind of gimmicks all the time, the electric chairs and seats and all that kind of stuff. But, one of the things, one of the biggest keys I wanted to say before we wrap up or anything about Night of the Living Dead was, naturally, the biggest key is that it inspired us to do this podcast. So that's... You know, I mean, from the title of it to what we're using for imagery on the website to, you know, the way we're kind of analyzing and dissecting everything, you know, to be such a simplistic idea that's led to such a mythos, and people even doing, you know, college theses on the influence of zombies in culture. 8 or 9 or however damn many seasons Walking Dead is on television now.
Mm-hmm. Oh, and that was a huge comic book before it was a movie. I mean, a television series.
Yeah.
Yeah, because I was reading that before it ever got snatched by AMC. I mean, I liked the comic book.
Who is that? Kirkman? Isn't that the guy that did it?
Yeah. Robert Kirkman. But that would be probably the hugest key other than us, because we're bigger than that.
That's right.
In our minds. But, yeah. Yeah, The Walking Dead is really a phenomenon I never expected to see. Not on television.
I would agree with that. And not on a non-pay cable television series, a network.
Right.
You know, I was amazed that it was AMC. It wasn't Showtime or HBO or something else that you had to pay for,
mm-hmm.
kind of thing. But hugely popular, even though season after season is just a retread of the other season. It's still hugely popular. So.
Right. But other than inspiring our podcast, and I think I heard Romero talk about this in one of the interviews I listened to. If not Romero, a lot of people know this, including Robert Kirkman and myself, you know, having written a zombie book. We're not attracted, or let's just put it this way, good zombie product, whether it be film, a book, a television series, is not about the zombies and the gore. That's just an accoutrement. Is that the right word?
Mm-hmm.
It's about the people and how they react. You know what? I think it was actually Stephen King that said this. How they react in this extraordinary situation. And if you don't like those people, if you don't like Rick and Michonne and Daryl, you don't give a shit what happens to them. And you don't have a story. You know?
True.
The zombies are a part of the world, but they're not what make zombie movies great. Zombie movies are about, you know, characters and stories.
Makes sense.
Yeah. Yep. I mean, even Crazy Barbara and Ben, you know, telling her to calm the fuck down.
Yeah.
You know?
I think you just need to calm down.
Stop it. You're ignorant. I could quote all lines right. from that movie all day.
Six or eight of these things, would I stand a chance with them?
Well, there's no problem. If you had a gun, shoot them in the head. That's a sure way to kill them. If you don't, get yourself a club or a torch. Beat them or burn them. They go up pretty easy.
Well, what? So any last thoughts or comments or whatever before we wrap up this wonderful week's podcast?
Not so much. The one thing, I guess, overall impressions of Night of the Living Dead is that it's a classic, it's a favorite, it's relentless, and it is an ending that is so strong that it basically morphed horror movies for the following decade.
Oh,
that's how I would sum
it
up.
2 decades, at least.
Yeah.
I would think, yeah.
And to this day, but I mean, it was the kickstart of people like John Carpenter and Tobe Hooper and Wes Craven.
Well, and I want to kind of say, I think what makes it work, and maybe this is just me and legacy feeling this way, but I think what makes it work is they didn't have an agenda. They wanted to create a movie that everybody pitched in on, that they all worked together, and it would be scary. And that's all they wanted. They didn't want a tentpole for a franchise. They didn't want to think about the marketing. They didn't want a blockbuster that was going to make $700 million the first weekend. You know, I mean, there was passion about the project again, and I'll keep bringing that up in all of our podcasts because I think it's something that means a lot to me and to you. Is, you know, the same thing with Carpenter wanted to make a really good scary movie with The Thing, and that's what he did, and everybody worked for it, and they froze to death up in the British Columbia or wherever they filmed it,
right?
You know, kind of thing, making it work and making it do it. And I think the best movies have an agenda for the source material rather than an agenda for remake, sequels, later on, legacy, whatever. You know, do the best work you can do right now, and if it gets popular, great, but it doesn't have to.
And the lack of money could help enforce that, the creativity.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, we've always Halloween, said, for sure.
We've always said that. You know, I think the best movies are the ones that don't have a lot of money. Because they have to be more inventive and more creative.
Right.
You know, even down to Star Wars. Star Wars was made for a cheap, cheap amount of money at the time when it came out.
Mm-hmm.
And they reinvented the science fiction film. So,
right.
And we've always said that. I'd rather you give me a million than 30 for a movie. Now, if you just want to give me the money, I'll take the 30. But you know, if we're making a movie, I'll go with more.
Well, inflation.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Cool.
Definitely one of my favorites. It inspired our podcast. We owe our lives to Night of the Living Dead.
And our deaths probably at one point. All right. So we'll wrap up this week and we'll talk to our talk at all you guys next time, sort of thing.
Thanks for tuning in.
Yep.
Thank you.
We'd like to thank you again for listening to Johnny Has the Keys podcast. You can contact us through our website, johnnyhasthekeys.com. And please don't forget to subscribe, rate, and review us on your podcasting app of choice. Johnny Has the Keys is supported in part via Patreon. For as little as a cup of coffee a month, help keep our podcast commercial free. The link is at the website. See you next show, and don't lose your keys.
Light these torches on.